guys really do roll right into that, don't you? Good enough. Okay. I want to thank you, Billy, for inviting me up here. It's an honor. It's a privilege anytime I get a chance to share. And ultimately, it's an obligation to give back just a little bit of what I've been so freely given. So thank you. I hope that you all will hear something you can use in your recovery tonight. My name is David Winship, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And I can tell you that the first gift that I was given by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was a choice between taking a drink today and a spiritual solution. That's the last gift I got because I've got that gift today. So I can tell you that with the unlimited grace of my higher power, the unconditional love in these rooms, some world-class sponsorship, and just a little bit of willingness on my part, I've been able to make that choice not to drink since October 16, 1992. I have a home group down in Charlottesville, North End. It's easy to get to from here. We hold five meetings Monday through Friday at noon and two women's meetings at 10:30 on Tuesday and Thursday. That's Peace and Recovery. And we'd love to see you. Come on down. I have a sponsor. He's got a sponsor. And he's got a sponsor, and that guy probably has a sponsor. I sponsor some men, and they sponsor some other men. So I like to think, Randy Kay says, the link in the chain. I like to think that I'm a link in the chain of sponsorship that reaches all the way back to Bill and Bob at one end, and hopefully today is reaching its hand out to the newcomer who just walked in the room. So that's enough about me. You all didn't tell me who you are. You know who I am. And so what I'd like to do, some of you look a little nervous. So what I want to do is I just want, let's let everybody know that we're all in the same place. We're all in the right place, okay, that I've walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I'm going to do is this is a little icebreaker that I do. It won't hurt. Nobody's going to get hurt. I've done it before, and some people like it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you something about me, and if it applies to you, just raise your hand, okay? All right, so let's start with, did you ever wreck a car after an evening of drinking? All right, I'm in the right place. How about two? Have you got any bikers in here, any motorcycle riders? Okay, got a few of us here. Okay, good. How about emergency room? Do you ever wake up in the emergency room, the doctor and nurses are sort of talking over you, your family and friends, after a night of drinking? Got a few. Jail. One night in jail, at least. We spent a few nights. Yeah, we got some between us, don't we? Let's talk about relationships. Now, I'm going to say marriages, but this applies to any long-term, serious relationship that you might have. Did you ever lose a perfectly good relationship because of your alcoholic behavior? How about two? All right, now I can't raise my hand for this, but anybody with three or more? Okay, all right, good. I'm glad you're here. Glad you're here, because I'm always willing to learn, but two is enough for me. Employment. Did you ever get fired for drinking on the job? Did you ever get fired for your alcoholic behavior? Alcoholism, alcoholic behavior. How about did you ever quit a perfectly good job because it just got in the way of your drinking? Any of those? Yeah. And this is my favorite. This is my favorite employment one. Did you ever take a job because you knew you could drink before, during, and after work? We call those bartenders. Hey, bartenders? Yeah, I got a few of those. Okay, all right, all right. I feel a little more at ease. You don't have to raise your hands on this one, but maybe you can relate. Did you ever sit across the table from somebody you love very much? And what's on the table between you is your addiction. And you know what she's going to say. She says, David, I know you love me. Can't you give this up for me? And you hate yourself when you say it. But what I say is, you know, people come and go. You're just passing through. My addiction is here to stay. My addiction is who I am. So not today, not you, not right now. Now, that wonderful list of stuff I like to call the gifts of active alcoholism. And it's just scratching the surface that all of us have lived. And so what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to take a bunch of your time telling you funny stories about how I embarrassed myself. I could be here until next Sunday telling you about the ridiculous things that I've done to myself and other people behind my addictions. I'm not going to do that because you've been there, you raised your hand, you've experienced the same things, we've all done the same stuff. All those consequences are the same for all of us. So what I do want to talk about a little bit is maybe how we got here, why we think we drank. I put a lot of thought into that. You know, you come into the rooms and you start thinking, why in the world would a sane, intelligent human being do that to themselves over and over and over? Why would you do that? Why would I drink? And in my thought on it, in the work that I've done on it, I've come up with a dozen or 15 different things, and I'm going to call them indignant victim stories, all right? And at the end of each one of these stories, I kind of end with a question, so is that why I drank? So I'm going to tell you two of those stories, and when I get to the end of them, you tell me whether you think that that's why I drank. My parents beat the hell out of me. They squashed any spirit that I might have. They told me that I was worthless, that I was worth nothing, that I was going to burn in hell for eternity. They told me that I was useless, lazy, and of no account. Now, when you're 4, 5, 6 years old, who are you going to believe? The people that are feeding you, right? And so I believed them. I was like, yeah, I'm nothing. I'm less than nothing. I'm worthless. And, but is that why I drank? You know, my folks were, you could call them holy rollers or born-again Christians, and they had a simple rule. You either, everything came down to this. You either accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, or you were going to burn in hell for eternity. I mean, those are the two choices they had. That's it. And I kind of thought growing up that there might be a little gray in there in life somewhere, but they didn't see it that way. They black and white. The Ten Commandments weren't enough. In my family, in addition to the Ten Commandments, we could not drink, smoke, curse, play with the devil's cards. Nobody has sex in my parents' religion, so I don't know how they make more of them, but nobody can have sex. We couldn't go to the movies. First movie I went to, I was a senior in high school, and that's because I was being defiant. And no, David, you can't play in that rock and roll band because rock and roll bands play for dances. And dances happen in the dark. And you know what happens in the dark. Evil. So in addition to all that, they believe the Old Testament thing about spare the rod, spoil the child. So nobody in my family was spoiled. I was the least spoiled. There were four of us. There was a cute one, a funny one, and a smart one. And that kind of left me with, somebody had to be the bad one, right? But the thing that I found is that all those other kids got all the attention, and I didn't get any attention. In my opinion, I didn't get there wasn't enough love, right? I couldn't get enough love. And so the only way to get attention around my family was to break the rules. So I'll be honest with you, every beating I got, I knew I was going to get because the rules were simple. Break a rule, you get beat. And it's like I would break the rules so that I could get beat. Kinda. And this turned out later in my life to give me some really kind of twisted relationships. Because on Sunday, my dad was saying, God is love. But Monday through Saturday, he's beating the hell out of me. And he would do this thing. He would pause. You know, he would be halfway through. He called it wailing the tar out of me. He'd be halfway through wailing the tar out of me. And he'd stop and he'd have a tear in his eye. Real dramatic. Tear in his eye. And he'd say, this hurts me more than it hurts you. And I'm like, bullshit. He would say, I only do this because I love you. Whack! You know, right back to it. And so I got this sense of God is love, but love is pain. So God is pain, pain is love. And I've been in some relationships in my time that you know, pain was just as good as love. It was absolutely just fine. Now, in my parents' defense, and I'll give them this, because I've done a fair amount of nine-step work on this, I think what they thought they were doing was building an upstanding young Christian man. That's what I think they thought they were doing. I think they thought they were beating the devil out of me, is what I think. But that's not the man I wanted to be. I didn't want to be my old man. It's like, boring. You know, I did not want to be that guy. I wanted to be Dean Martin. Dean Martin had a cocktail in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Good-looking guy, could sing like a bird, women dropping off of him, you know. I was like, he wasn't burning in hell. Dean was doing just fine. So that's the guy I wanted to be. So because my spirit was squashed, let's just say, is that why I drank? Is that why I'm an alcoholic? I don't think so. So let me tell you the second story. Second story is that I turned 21 in the middle of a year of mortal fear. Fear for my life. And I suffered from something that didn't even exist then, but it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, is what they call it. And so I guess my question about that is that why I drank? So, you know, the short story on this is that I started drinking when I was 17, and it became real clear to me that I was not going to be able to drink the way I wanted to drink and live with these people who are these holy rollers. It was not going to be a good combination. So I ran away to college as soon as I could, and I said, I've got control of my life. For the first time I have control, I'm going to drive this boat, right? 2 weeks later, in jail, Washtenaw County, drunk in public. Because I was chugging gin out of a bottle. You know, I mean, who knew? That's not how you drink a martini, right? But it was liquor, it was me, we belonged together. That was the deal. So I ended up in jail, and I between the booze and the reefer, I cycled out of college in, like, jig time. So I'm 19 years old. I don't have a skill. I don't have a job. I don't have a clue. But my brother just got back from Vietnam about that time. He had this nice uniform, had a couple of medals, and you know what he got? 24/7, the whole year my brother was gone, he got my parents' and my family's attention. It was like, oh, Kent, Ted Offensive. Oh, Kent, let's give him a care package. Oh, Kent, we haven't heard from him in 2 weeks. I hope he's okay. And I'm like, hell, I can do that. Sign me up. So I got lots of attention. I landed in a place where I got so much attention that every single person in this place hated me, hated my guts. And 50% of them were trying actively to kill me with AK-47s and RPGs and grenades and stuff like that. I turned 21 in the middle of that year. And, you know, we talk about fear in these rooms. We talk about self-centered fear. And we talk about how self-centered fear is the chief activator of our defects. And we talk about how that fear usually manifests itself as, I don't get what I want, or I'm going to lose what I have, right? I mean, we talk about fear all the time. The kind of fear that I'm talking about is different. This kind of fear is when you wake up in the morning and your guts are like this, and you can't keep anything down, and the first thing you do as soon as you wake up is you vomit because you're just like this. And I smoke a cigarette, and I look at the date, and I say, okay, November 23rd. Okay, today's the day I die. And I just sort of start my day looking for the situation that's going to take me out. I have to just kind of believe that that's going to be what happens. It's the kind of fear where a guy comes up and he puts a pistol in your eye and he says, I'm going to kill you today. And the first time he does that, what do? You're like, whoa, no, not you, not kill, not me, not today, okay? Your first response is visceral. It's like, no, don't kill me. But this guy's doing this all day, every day. This guy's coming up to you all day and saying, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. And it's like, you know he can do it because the place is raining death. Your enemies, they're all dying. Your friends, they're all dying. Innocent women and children, they're all dying. Everybody dies. But not me, not yet. So you're 6 or 8 weeks into this, you're 3-4 months into this, this guy's doing this all day long, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you, and pretty soon you're like, you know, I know that you can, but you haven't yet. And then it turns into kind of like, bring it. And after a year of that crap, you are so sick of hearing it, you're so sick of seeing it, that your attitude is like, take me. It's better than what I'm putting up with listening to your crap all day long. And so you get this twisted, I'm not saying this is a healthy attitude, but this is an attitude that comes, and if you've ever been there, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it turned me into kind of a thrill junkie. I got back to the States and I jumped out of perfectly good airplanes. I bought the biggest motorcycles I could get and I rode those boys just wide open. I would be stumbling drunk. I would stumble to my bike and fire it up and go out on the expressway and weave in and out of cars at 95 miles an hour. Now, I don't think that I wanted to die. I don't think I had a death wish. But I had no respect. So my life, my death, it didn't matter. Your life, your death, I don't care. Feelings, I don't have them. If you have feelings, you got a problem. You need to just keep it to yourself. Because we're not here to talk about your feelings. I don't care. And that kind of ties into the PTSD thing. The skills that you learn in a dangerous environment, a life-threatening environment, the skills you learn to survive. In that environment, you learn how to be like ready to rock at every second. You learn how to respond definitively, aggressively, powerfully. You're just sort of like this amped up rage all the time. You've got to be ready to respond, right? Because it's going to save your life. Well, that doesn't play too well standing in line at the Kroger. It doesn't play too well when you're in a relationship with your parents or your brother, your sister. It doesn't play too well when you're in a love relationship with somebody. Because when somebody tells me no and I explode because I'm waiting too long at the stoplight, I mean, it doesn't go well. So you take all this stuff, this 21-year-old kid, he's got all this self-loathing, and then he's got all this fear and all this anger. And you ask the question, so is that why I drank? I don't think so. I think that stuff is just life circumstances. I think that stuff happens to everybody. Dr. Silkworth, in this book here, says that the reason people drink is because they like the effect that alcohol produces. So I had to look at that, you know, and I'm going through all this stuff about why did I drink? And I'm thinking, okay, the effect that I liked, I know the effect that I like. 5 or 6 drinks in, I'm no longer that 15-year-old kid whose old man is kicking his butt because he broke some rule. 5 or 6 drinks in, I don't care whether there's enough love in the world for me because I got enough drugs and alcohol that who needs love? I'm high. Who needs love? I'm high. 5 or 6 drinks in, and I'm not thinking about survivor guilt. You know, the guys who didn't make it back? I'm not thinking about that. And when I get the goal of my drinking, which is to pass out, I don't have those combat nightmares anymore. So for me, the effect that I liked is that I became a different guy when I drank. 5 or 6 drinks in, and I was happy, joyous, and free. 5 or 6 drinks in, and I'm having a spiritual experience. But there's a little problem with David. And I think we all share this problem. And that problem is that 5 or 6 drinks in isn't enough. What happens to me when I drink is I have what we call a phenomenon of craving. And when I start drinking, it's not over till it's over. You know, if I could quit at 5 or 6 drinks, I'd be in the White House, right? Or the Senate. How hard is it? You know, really, how hard is it? But I couldn't. When I drank, one of 3 things happened. Either you ran out of booze, I passed out, or things got ugly and you had to cut me off. And I advise, just don't. Let me pass out. And that's the way I drank for 25 years. And you take all of that self-loathing that I learned and you take all of that anger. And you take those substances that I was addicted to and you kind of mix them all together and then you add a bunch of speed. And you got to have speed so that you can drink longer without passing out, right? And you got to have hallucinogenics so that you can really change who you are. I mean, acid will really change who you are. And then you mix in some sex addiction. or you mix in a lot of sex addiction. And what you've got is, you've got the man that I built, right? My parents were trying to build an upstanding Christian young man by beating the devil out of me. And so this is what I built. And so for 25 years, I drank and drugged my way into all of those gifts of active alcoholism that we raised our hands to, and more, and more. I lost everything. So I'm 44 years old. What happened? So this is the what happened part, okay? What happened is I'm 44 years old, and I've lost everything twice. I like to say that because I was just wrapping up my second divorce, and I had more jobs than you see on an Excel spreadsheet. I quit graduate school with a semester and one class to go because I had a resentment. I'll show you. I'm quitting. All these keen alcoholic decisions that I made that were just absolutely loss after loss after loss. And I'm 44 years old, and I've got one thing that has any value to me at all, and that's a relationship with a woman. Now, this woman is different, totally different. She's different in two ways. One is, I care about her feelings. First time ever. You know those feelings I put away? I cared about her feelings. The second thing is, I was willing to change to be in this relationship with her. And that's a first time. But I didn't know how to change. So I treated her like I treated everybody else. Like dirt, like a dog. And there are two times I'm going to talk about where I had a divine intervention, and this is one. She gave me an ultimatum. She said, David, I love you very much. I think we can have a great relationship. I think we can do this for the long run, and I'm in it with you. Let's do this thing. Or you can do whatever you're doing with your little friends over here. But, honey, you can't have both. And I'm like, well, that's harsh. You clearly don't know who I think I am. But I really wanted what she had. And I don't mean in the fifth chapter way. I mean, I really wanted what she had. And I wanted what I thought we could have together. So I went to counseling for this problem that I had. And it took the guy like no time at all to say, do you realize that your life is in the toilet and somebody is just perpetually flushing that thing and you're just going down and down? I said, yeah, I know, man. I'm a drunk. I drink. And he said, well, there's a connection between all the stuff you're addicted to and the fact that your life is in the toilet. And so he suggested that I might want to try an AA meeting. So I went to this AA meeting, okay? And I'm at my first AA meeting, about this many people sitting in a big circle like this over at Hinton Avenue on a Friday night, 8 o'clock. And it was the greatest thing. This guy over here started telling my story, and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. You've been watching. And this guy started telling my story, and it's like, wait a minute. And then this guy started talking, and I said, dude, I can tell you some stories. Right? And I'm feeling like at home. And then two guys over here shared. And one of them said that he had lived in an alley and ate out of a dumpster. And I've never done that. And this guy over here shared that he had drank Sterno. And I had never done that. And so it was like that scene from Christmas Carol. Scrooge is sitting there and he's got the past and the present and the future. And he's like, here is my past, David, and here is my future. This is where you're going. If you don't do something, get off the train now. And I did. I did. I was in this room with all these people. They were telling me these stories that were my story, past and future. And they said, we're not drinking today. And I'm like, bullshit. And they said, we're not drinking today. I said, okay. All right. So I went home and I poured all my stuff down the drain, right? Friday night, what a thing to do. Saturday morning, I get up and I go to my second meeting. And I walk into this meeting, and these people are all hugging and munching each other and laughing and kissing. And they're reading out of As-Bill something or other. And these words are all just going over my head, you know, 10:30 on a Saturday morning. And I'm just like, oh, man, it's been about, I don't know, 30 hours since my last drink. And you know what they did at the end? They gathered up in a circle and held hands and they prayed. And I was like, oh, man, oh, I don't know. I walked out of there and I smoked a cigarette and I walked home and I thought, I'm not sure I can do this. Holding hands with a bunch of strangers and praying? I mean, that's what got me, right? Holding hands with strangers and praying. And I'm like, no, man, I don't know. I'm not sure I can do this. But I didn't drink that day. I went a whole day and I didn't drink. I got up on Sunday morning and there's a meeting at 9 o'clock. At Sunday morning, and it was in the World Building downtown Charlottesville in this tiny little room about, you know, this wide, and nothing but east-facing windows. And it's 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and I'll be honest, I hadn't seen that many 9 o'clocks on Sunday morning. But I hadn't had a drink in a day, and I walked into this room, and the lights are just pouring in like this, you know, and I'm walking in like this. And there's a guy over there by the coffee pot, and he says, "You looking for a meeting?" And I said, I think so. He said, good. Get a cup of coffee. Have a seat. Maybe you'll hear something that's good for you. And then he said, relax, you're home. And I thought to myself, I got my coffee and I'm sitting down. Relax, you're home. I thought, that's a really odd thing to say, isn't it? You're home. And so I sat down. And I just listened. And you people started talking. And you know what I realized at the end of that meeting? I realized that I was home. I was home more than I'd ever been in my family, more than I'd ever been in the army, more than I'd ever been in years of drinking and drugging. I never have felt at home. But I was here with you, and you were telling my story, and you people knew where I'd been. You told me you did. You'd done what I'd done. Some of you have a whole lot better stories than I do. And I was listening. And I thought, wow, I'm home. And I've felt that in every AA meeting I've gone to since. You walk up to the meeting. I've been in other countries. I've been in other states. And you walk up and there's somebody who's saying, "Hi, my name's Jeremy. Glad you're here." Where do they do that? Where do they do that? They don't do that anywhere but here. So I'm home. I'm feeling at home. And so I walked out of that meeting. It's like, what do I have to do? Well, I did 90 meetings in 90 days. Good idea. I got a sponsor. Great idea. We started working the steps kind of the best I could, given my state of mind at the time. I mean, I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. I couldn't put two sentences together. But I was doing what this guy told me to do, and I was showing up where he said to. And you know what started to happen to me? Things started getting better. About 3 or 4 months in, somewhere in there, I went a whole day and didn't think about taking a drink. A whole day and didn't even think about taking a drink. And time went on, and you know, the next thing you know, I get to marry that woman that I was so crazy about. Awesome. We end up with this beautiful little house. I get a great job. I got a job. I'm making a buttload of money. And you know what? This took about 5 or 6 years. 6 years. And at the end of that time, I had all those things that I lost twice, I had back in spades. And I was peaceful. I was happy, joyous, and free. I truly was. Life was great. It was really good. I even quit smoking. I'd been smoking for 33 years, and I even quit smoking during that time period. But something happened, and a friend of mine calls it, he says, I let the gifts of AA get in the way of my recovery. Now that sounds kind of stupid, doesn't it? That's exactly what I did. We were living 12 miles out of town, 12 whole miles out of town. My meetings went from 5 to 3 to 1. And then I actually said to people, you know what? I don't need those meetings. I'm cured. I'm recovered from alcoholism. I don't need the meetings. I'm good. I haven't had a drink in 6 years. I'm good. And so this next part of my story I call wandering in a spiritual desert for 12 years, because that's exactly what I did. It didn't happen right away. But I started taking all my character defects back, the ones that my higher powers so graciously took away from me the first time in step 6 and 7. I took all those back. And you know what? Higher power and I used to be on kind of a daily communication basis. We stopped talking. We weren't on a first name basis. Hell, we didn't even know each other's name. I didn't need higher power. I'm cured. I'm good. I was working a lot, so it was just inconvenient. And so you know where I found myself? You don't mind if I read a little bit, do you? I found myself right here on page 52. This is 18 years. This is 18 years since my last drink, okay? We are having trouble with our personal relationships. My wife said to me, dude, you need therapy. And I thought, therapy? We couldn't control our emotional natures. By this time, I had cycled through 5 jobs in this 12-year time period, and I was working for a guy that I hated. I hated the job. I hated myself for working for this guy. And he came in one day, unexpected, and said something to me, and I went off. You know that PTSD? And I just, what they said in the hearing is that I went on for 15 minutes with a stream of cursing like no one had ever heard before. I do know how to curse. And so I think that this part about I couldn't control my emotional nature was true. I was a prey to misery. I was horrible. And depression. I couldn't make a living. 6 jobs. You'll find out in a minute. 6 jobs in 12 years. A feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear. I was unhappy. I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Check. That was me. So what that describes for me is a spiritual malady is what that describes for me. That's what we have. That's what we all have right there. What this describes for me is untreated alcoholism. So 18 years since my last drink, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. I didn't know that, but that's what I have learned. So divine intervention number 2. I walk into this guy's office the next Monday, and he said, you are so out of here. Why are you even here? Don't come back. And so I had a little time on my hands. And I started going to AA meetings again. I started going every day. And I found that sometimes I'd go 2 days just because I felt so good. And you know what happened to me in those meetings? I heard this thing, this one thing, I heard this every day for 2 weeks. Somebody said these words or something really similar to these words. They said, my life didn't change till I worked the steps the way they're written in the book. Now, the first couple times you hear that, you're like, okay, I've heard that. The 9th time you hear that, you're like, okay, I got it. And so I got a big book thumping sponsor. This guy thumped. We went through every word, starting with page 1 through 164. We worked the steps exactly the way that they are written in the book. That's what we did. And I learned a couple of things about the steps. The first thing I learned is that once I admit to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, I know what my problem is. If I know what my problem is, then there's a solution, and I know what the solution is. And it's real clear. You know, that Dr. Jung said it to that guy. What's his name? Roland. He said to Roland, you know what? There's only one choice for you, dude. You need a spiritual experience or you're dead. It's your only hope. The second thing I learned is that, and we're going to talk about this in just a second. The second thing I learned is that, you know, the instructions are really clear. It's a clearly prescribed set of instructions, these steps that are in here. And they promise you a specific guaranteed result. They say that if you work these steps, you're going to have a spiritual experience. The spiritual experience, isn't that what keeps me sober? Yeah. Yeah. So, we worked the steps, and what I came to believe is that the entire program lays out for me like this. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous helps me to see what my problem is, and then it immediately gives me a solution. Now, I've said this before. If you could only give me 2 pages out of the book, they would be pages 24 and 25. And it goes like this. We're talking about powerlessness. And it says that it's a fact that alcoholics, that's us, for some obscure reason, have lost the power of choice and drink. It says that we cannot remember all that stuff that happened to us. Hell, last month, last week, we're talking about yesterday. I don't remember what's happening. It says that there are certain consequences that follow even taking a glass of beer, and we know what those are because they're all those things that we raise our hand to at the beginning. And we get to a place where we say, what's the use anyhow? And that's me. Now, this paragraph at the bottom of 24 says, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. So let me get this straight, sponsor. If you don't lock me up, I'm going to die or go insane. He's like, yeah. It's like, that's a problem. That's a problem for me. It's life and death. But on the very next page, right at the top of the page, 4 words, there is a solution. It's like, boom, Solution. So you got a problem. You know what it is. Here's the solution. Now, I know you're not going to like this because it says right here, almost none of us liked the self-searching, leveling of our pride, confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. Now, I'm just going to pause here for a second and mention leveling of pride, confession of shortcomings, and self-searching. That's steps 4 through 9. I don't care how you call it. This tells me that nobody likes doing it. Check. And it says that the process requires it for its successful consummation. Now, you can argue that the steps are but suggestions if you wish. But this sentence says that they're requirements. 4 through 9 are requirements for the successful consummation. So what is that successful consummation, supposing you want it? A deep and effective spiritual experience which has revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. That's what a successful consummation is. And you get it by working the steps, specifically 4 through 9. Now, just in case you didn't get it, David, you half-stepper, you, down here at the bottom of the page it says, there's no middle-of-the-road solution. If you're in a position where life's impossible and you pass in this region from which there's no return through human aid, we just talked about that on the previous page, you've got two alternatives. And here we are with that choice again, okay? You can go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation, or you can accept spiritual help. Cake or death. Okay. So to me, the steps lay out just like that. What's my problem? Here's the solution. So I come into the rooms, and I'm just going to go through this real briefly. I come into the rooms. My life is in the toilet. I am powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. That's a problem. Boom, solution. Believe in a power greater than me. Turn my will and my life over to that power. And guess what? That little problem starts to become solved. That's where I lose the obsession to drink. That's where I lose it. But you know what? I get to the point where I was in that 12-year period where I'm not communicating with my higher power, and you know what's in the way? You know what's between me and HP? My character defects. Boom. Solution. Searching fearless moral inventory. Share it with somebody else, God and yourself. Become willing to have that stuff removed, and then ask. 4 through 7. Whoa. You go through that stuff. There's nobody in here who's done that who won't tell you that it was a life-changing experience. But you know, I'm carrying around this backpack full of rocks. And all of those rocks are every single shitty thing I did to every person I've done all my life. That's a problem. It's a problem. Solution. Write down every single name. Talk to those people face to face. Make it right the best you can. Now, this is the truth. That was the hardest work I've ever done. And just putting in a pitch here for don't stop the first time around. Just do the steps again. Because, you know, that relationship I had with my father where I hated him his whole life until he died? It's a whole lot easier to do those amends when people are alive than when they're dead. I'm just going to mention that. So if you've got an outstanding amend, now's a good time to take care. I'm just saying. But I was 18 years sober before I finally worked the steps enough times that I was able to realize my part, ask for forgiveness, and give forgiveness to that man who is now long gone. Didn't do him a bit of good, but I tell you what, my life changed in the 9th step. Hardest work I've ever done. But I've got one more problem, and that is that I'm an alcoholic. I've got alcoholism. I'm going to die with alcoholism. That part doesn't change. The day I die, I'm going to be an alcoholic. And that's a problem for me, you know? Boom. Solution. How about if you take a daily personal inventory and just sort of figure out how you've been today? You can take credit for the good stuff you've done, but how about if you make stuff right that you didn't? How about if you try to improve that relationship you've got with your higher power so that it's not just sort of a once-a-day thing? How about if you try to bring that into your daily life, into your daily practice? And then the promise comes true. The 12-step promise says you will have had a spiritual awakening. It says that you will have had a personal transformation that can't be described in human terms. That's what I call it. Sandy Beach's phrase, not mine. I love that phrase. It says that you'll have that. So you've got a responsibility. You've got two of them. One is to share it with every single alcoholic you see. The other one is to live a principled life. And those principles are very clear in the book. So that's what happened to me about 4 years ago. I worked the steps with a loving sponsor, and I had that personal transformation that can't be described in purely human terms. I had that experience. And I've learned that I can maintain that relationship by my daily work, by work I do every day in this book, in these rooms, with other alcoholics. That's what I've learned. So that's what happened. So what's it like today? 1, 2, 3. Good. I was talking with a friend a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know something? This is old-fashioned. They haven't changed this thing in 80 years. And I said, and how recently did alcoholism change? You know what I mean? Just saying. The problem is the same. The solution is the same. It doesn't need to change. The answer is here. And so when I came into the rooms, what they told me is that I wouldn't get that phenomenon of craving if I didn't take the first drink. And so to me, my whole program is about how not to take the first drink. And the way that comes down is they say, don't drink today. Don't drink, go to meetings, they say. It's like, you kind of skip over that real quickly, but that don't drink part is not so easy when I'm 30 hours away from my last drink. So how do you do that? So here are the things they told me. I'm going to give you, there are five of them. They said, go to a meeting every day. David goes to a meeting every day. Sometimes I go to more just because I feel so damn good when I get out. I love meetings. You know why I go to meetings? I go to meetings for two reasons. One is because I will forget. I've proven that I will forget the solution if I don't hear you remind me. So you folks talk and you share up here and you tell me what my solution is for my problem, because we've got the same problem. The other thing I do is I go there to be of service to you, because I got to contribute. That's what my sponsor told me. You don't like what they said in the meeting? What did you contribute, David? Like that. So I go to a meeting every day. Second thing is I ask for help every day. Now, you do it the way you want, but the way I do it is that I get down on my knees and I ask my higher power to take my will, to take my life, to guide my thoughts and my recovery, and to show me how to live today. Now, I say a bunch of other stuff too, but basically I ask for help from a higher power today. Third thing is I got to have a sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, you need a sponsor. It's that simple. I got to have a sponsor. I'm in regular contact with my sponsor. We meet every other week, but we see each other at least once a week, and we're on the text or phone probably 2 or 3 times a week. The reason I need a sponsor is because, man, I'm new to the program. I can't understand this stuff. You know, it's like all those words going over my head. This guy knows my case. He's heard my 4-step, and he gives me a personalized, customized program of recovery based on who I am and based on what it says in here, because he's been there. Sponsor. Fourth thing is I got to be working the steps. Now, people do this different ways. Some people will go through the steps the first time and then just do 10, 11, 12, 10, 11, 12. Now, that's fine. I love that. What this alcoholic does is believes that there is a step after step 12, and that's step 1. And so when I'm done with 12, I start with 1 again. Now, you need to be able, if you see me on the street, to say, hey, David, what step are you on? And I need to be able to tell you, I'm working 2, I'm working 6. Today, I'm working step 10. I'm having a great time with step 10, and I'm seeing some change in my life that is unlike anything I've seen since step 6. It's really powerful stuff when you do it the way it's written in the book. So I work the steps, because if I'm not working on a step, what am I working on? I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. So I got to be working the steps. The last thing is I got to be of service to other suffering alcoholics. Now, you don't have to sponsor. Some people aren't ready to sponsor. Some people aren't capable of sponsoring. But somebody made that coffee. Somebody brought in the cookies. Somebody set this place up. Somebody set the chairs up. And you know what? If you've got a day, you've got a day more than the guy who just walked in. And you know what you can do? You can say to him, hey, man, I know how you feel. It gets better. I know how you feel. I've been there. Keep coming back. You can say to him, relax, you're home, because you've felt it. You can share your experience. It doesn't matter where you are. So, If I do a couple of those things in a day, I'm just going to be, I'm not going to drink. I figure two of those five things I just said, if I do two of those things today, I won't drink. I won't take that first drink. If I do three of those things, my wife is going to love me. My friends are going to call me and ask my opinion. I'm going to call them and they're going to tell me the truth, right? That it's going to be, life is good. If I do all five of those things in a day, you know what's going to happen? I'm going to have a peaceful mind and a loving heart. I'm going to have that personal transformation that can't be described in human terms. I'm going to be serene. I'm going to be so blessed that I'm embarrassed to tell you about the blessings in my life. I am that blessed today. I'm embarrassed. People say, how are you doing, man? It's like, I give them the answer, I'm doing all right. Man, you don't want to hear how well I'm doing. Life is just beyond fabulous. I didn't do it. I didn't do any of this. So what I'll tell you is this, and I'm wrapping up. Perfect. That I don't believe the steps are what keeps me sober. I don't believe that sponsorship or literature or meetings keep me sober. I think that what keeps me sober is that relationship with a power greater than myself that restores me to sanity, just like it says in the book. And the way I get that relationship is all those five things. Those five things give me the relationship with a power greater than myself. So what does that relationship give me? How does that work? All that really gives me is free choice. I've got that choice we talked about right at the very, very beginning. I get that choice because of the relationship that I've got with a power greater than myself. When I was drinking, I didn't have a choice. I didn't see a choice. There was only one thing to do, and that's more. Bring it on, give me more, make it a double, you know? But now I've got a choice. I don't have to drink today. I can drink today, or I can accept a spiritual solution. I can act like a fool, or I can live a principled life. I can be in conscious contact with my higher power, or I can be unconscious. That's my choice. But I get that choice. So, if you're sober today and you're not doing any of that stuff, God bless you. I'm glad you're working a great program. But for this alcoholic, there's no substitute for a spiritual experience. But you have to do the work to get it. It's that simple. So my favorite part of every meeting is when we kind of round up. Now, you'll remember that this is the part that I hated about those first meetings I went to. But my favorite part of every meeting now is when we round up at the end and we all hold hands. Because my higher power connects with your higher power and your higher power all the way around the room. Yours and yours and yours all the way around the room. And for like 30 seconds, I'm feeling all our higher powers connected just for a minute. With a single purpose, and that is to help us recover from a hopeless condition of mind and body. I mean, how beautiful is that, really? How beautiful is that? I get to feel that every meeting. And then what do we say? We say the most important words that I can say to you tonight. This really works, but you have to work it. Thanks.